Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Kim Deitch, and I have a special guest as well, Art Spiegelman, to introduce him. Kim Deitch is the author, the artist, most recently, of The Boulevard of Broken Dreams. It comes from Pantheon Press, and I am kind of happy. Back, I rested an interview with Art Spiegelman about the second volume of Mouse, and we became friends. Now, when I go to New York, I'm frequently at his house where I am the happy recipient of things thrown at me. The first issues of Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan series, all sorts of things that he feels that I should know. And then, at a certain point, a bunch of color Xeroxes of the work of Kim Deitch, who, although he has had collections in comic book form, mostly from Fantagraphics, has never had a hardcover book of his work, and this is the first. I think that he's a favorite of yours, Art. Can you tell me what fascinated you about Kim Deitch?
Well, it started pretty early on, before there was even a real definition of what this underground comic stuff might be, when I just like gotten into that world in New York and the East Village Other and the 67 or so, you know. And Kim was a couple of years older than me and was like doing this amazing work that seemed to like have the same frames of reference that I was interested in at the time. He loved Little Nemo. He loved 1930s culture. And before even meeting him, the pages were, how can I say this? They, you know, I was aware of Robert Crumb's work, and it was very accomplished at the time to see. And Kim's work stood out from a lot of the other kind of odd drawings that I was seeing in the underground press, and that it had its own way of being accomplished, but it wasn't that it was drawn in some kind of classically correct way. It just was like it had a lot of energy and a lot of reference to it. It had a lot of it was deep, you know. It went back in time to other things, and the pages really bounced. He had a really strong graphic energy to what he was doing, and it got me really excited the first time I saw it, because somehow, although the work didn't look like it was done at all at the turn of the 20th century when comics began, it had some of the same crackle of that stuff, you know. So he became an artist that I just admired from the get-go, and it was at the very beginning of forming what might be looked on as a generation of cartoonists, so underground comics artists. And over the years, we became friends, and I've kind of pursued everything that Kim's done ever since with real fever, you know. I've really grown to love it a lot. And part of that is because it wasn't as apparent at the beginning, but now it's clear to me that it's somehow really one world, you know. Like, there's stories that look like they're kind of just genre yarns. And then there's things that feel a little bit more like even slice-of-life things. And then there's stuff that feels like science fiction, like funny animal stories. And yet somehow they're weaving together to become as densely textured a world in their own way as Faulkner's is.
It's very funny because, you know, when I was speaking to Art the other night, he pointed out to me that just as I read the work of all the work of the writers I have on the show, that it would be less than respectful not to know a good deal of the work of Kim Deitch. And I sense that what you say is true. As you read other stories in his oeuvre, you sense them straining to join the story you've just read. So it wouldn't be surprising to find Molly O'Dare from an earlier story sauntering into the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, because it does have the sense that there was once an amazing good place, the great good place, where cartoons and movies and comic books and old songs all came together. Perhaps they were, in fact, the same thing. They're almost, some of these cartoons, like those old versions of sing-alongs, where the words would become pictures and the audience would be enjoined to sing. And there's a sense always that there's a soundtrack. It seems in a way like a mastercraft, a joining of all sorts of beloved things from the great good place. Is that what it's like for you, Kim?
Well, it does have to all make sense to me. And it's funny you mentioned Molly O'Dare sauntering in, because she is going to saunter into my very next comic book. Because, yeah, it all has to make logical sense to me. Of course, I know it's a fantasy and I'm making it up, but it needs to seem real to me.
I'd say one of the things that's really especially kind of nifty to me is, like, you're saying it has a soundtrack, it has this, it has that, which is true, but what it has that's so specific to comics, and that's part of what really makes it live for me, is these pages really bounce. You know, if there's a bouncing ball in that animated cartoon, there's a bouncing ball, which is your eye, and it's moving mm-hmm. around the blacks, whites, and grays of all this stuff. And Kim's like a real master of keeping that layout lively. You know, it's like it's not like a bunch of same-sized rectangles taking you through, which is certainly a valid way of doing comics, but it's really not that. You get the excitement of having all these pictures, like, climbing into each other, the same way the narratives climb into each other from one story to the next.
Well, I got that from Jack Cole, you know.
But you also got it from Bosch and from Blake, I think.
Well, Blake was also an early inspiration to me, strangely enough. You know, when I used to work as an orderly in the Nut House, I got into reading the poetry of William Blake, and in some weird way, it inspired me to take a shot at being an artist.
You pick up the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and you get the sense that any page is full to bursting. How do you get that quality?
That's a hard question to answer. Hard work. That's how I get it. I sit there and I make a layout and I prepare the page and just keep at it until it looks nice.
Part of the way it's, that Kim's an inspiration is that hard work thing is no joke. I mean, I don't know if I showed you any of Kim's preparatory sketches or Xeroxes of those things, and like the workup before he actually begins doing a strip is enormous, you know?
Yeah, it's not a spontaneous process. Like, I wrote whole scenes for the Boulevard of Broken Dream that I knew damn well I wasn't going to use just to help get into the high mystic mood of it, you know?
I'm talking to Kim Deitch, the creator of the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, which is a book of related stories in which the haunting cat, Waldo, has afflicted a series of generations of cartoonists, and he is sort of the cat of the zeitgeist. He is the person, the thing that makes everything bad. He instills lust in someone who's known for his purity, or ambitious greed in someone who might otherwise be altruistic. He's almost like the spirit of the time. He's what ruins it all. I was looking at page, if we open our storybooks
really
to page
numbers, yeah.
Yeah, but at the picture of old Mishkin sitting, sleeping on his armchair next to his nephew, and they are simultaneously watching TV and perhaps listening to the Victrola. There are wrangled beers around them. And one of the things that I noticed immediately is that in the Deitch world, nothing is ever single. So if you have an old man sleeping with a young man alert next to him on the TV set, you have an old cat cartoonist sleeping with Waldo, the evil cat, strumming his guitar or ukulele in an attempt to wake him up. But up above, on the wall, there's yet another pairing of the old cartoonist Winsor Newton standing in back of the young Mishkin, who is drawing his Milton the Elephant from a prototype, and it's going to be done frame by frame. What I love here is that time past, time present, time future, they all conjoin, dream time too, within a single picture. And are all of these pictures separately done and then collaged? I mean, it's unthinkable, because you clearly know so much about the generations of these people, and any single frame tells you, but it takes the reader a whole reading or two before you get the sense of how everything fits together and when it fit together.
And I'm learning stuff I didn't know myself.
But I tell you, I was telling Kim this is going to be a good come along, this is going to be worth it, because Michael is a really good reader. Yeah. You know? And it's something I really love about you, Michael. It's really great. Like, you really know how to look.
Yeah, I'm finding this quite interesting myself. I now that you say it, I'm noticing it, but, you know, it wasn't like something I consciously did.
But it's so interesting to me. I kind of knew that, and yet it's so consistent that what I'm interested in here is, what is it that you know when you don't know what you're doing? Because, yeah, a lot of art is unconscious. That's why it thrills us. You know, we who kind of sit and peer at it through, you know, thick lenses and in a kind of bewilderment and delight, we're seeing things that we know weren't put there intentionally, and yet they got there. Do you have any idea, do you have any way of saying what it is you do when you do it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. I'm a great believer in using the subconscious mind, and I definitely, you know, I try to plant stuff in my brain way ahead of when I'm going to have to need it, so it'll be there when I do want it. You know, I really think you can do that, that you can really organize your brain in such a way so that you get more use out of it.
Also because Kim tends to plan what he's doing, it's not sort of like, well, I think I'm going to just improvise this. I mean, he's done that, I think, but it's not really like, I'll start here and see where this one goes. There's a real kind of set of drafts that build into this thing, and that means that there's more and more time for the brain to make connections.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in being unspontaneous.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Albert Pinkham Ryder in the introduction, and Ryder is an American painter, often compared to Melville, who is famous for the buildup of layer upon layer upon layer of paint, yeah, until what we've got, what we're looking at, is not just a painting, but an excavation of the series of moods that produced the painting. And that's what I find in Kim Deitch's work, that sense that there's a past, there's a present, and you've got to get it all in. They're the things that you dreamed and that the things that you're afraid will happen, and they're all going to make it into the frame, but not just make it into the frame. They're going to be orchestrated there so that the mega Deitch frames are like Busby Berkeley routines in which past dances up and down a staircase with the present. Well, I was once reading a book about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, I think one that Arlene Croce wrote, and she said that those enormous dance numbers took place on something they called the BWS, the Big White Set. That would be the set that was built. It would have staircases and ladders and stages and platforms, and you would do the big dance number on it. And it's almost as if in the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, things have been set up for the big production number in which everything happens simultaneously on, if not the big white set, the big black and white set, in which there is an arrangement, a space, for elephants to consort with frogs and for moons to sing down onto spooning lovers and for the musicians who are scoring the music to be standing next to the clock that's in the process of lifting a mallet to ding its own bell in its steeple. I mean, this thing seems to me to be the culmination of the imagination of the strips. Do they come late on, or are they where you begin?
No, it's a slow build-up. You know, there's always a point at which I'm going like, oh my God, how am I ever going to put all of this together, you know? And sometimes the only way I can get started is just think, well, I got the track record. I've done it before. I'll do it again. You sort of have to slow yourself down and, you know, just start building it up. I'm doing that right now. I'm, you know, not the second, but, you know, with another story.
I would say that because it's all so structured, that Kim starts, I would guess, that you start knowing that, okay, I'm going for the money shot here. There's like a big scene coming up, and I've really got to like do my push-ups in order to get there. And that you've got to go for broke at certain points in the story to like make it all hang. And that animated cartoon sequence within this that Michael's talking about seems to me is one of those places where you kind of, You were bracing yourself for it before you did it, I would guess.
Actually, my brother Simon was working on it while I was working on other parts of the book, and that particular one you're mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's going to be really great scenes in certain places. Yeah, it's trying to get all the things you want to get into the story and make it all work. And it all, you know, at some point, it does seem like, oh, my God, how is this going to happen? And you just start to get a bigger and bigger pile of papers, and it's looking weirder and weirder on your desk. But somehow it does happen.
But, you know, one thing also that I found with Kim is, like, we definitely have some overlapping interests in, like, the old cartoons, the old comic books, whatever. Kim also has an incredibly, vast store of knowledge about 19th century literature. You know, like, he likes reading 19th century novelists, you know, the Dickens and the Dickens is just one layer.
He is able to do one-page versions of them in one of the early
Zero Zeros. Right.
There are one-page classics.
I did that Oliver Twist without even looking at the book, too, because I've read it so many times.
Dickens is just one of many Victorian-era novelists.
Oh, it's not just Dickens. It's Upton Sinclair and Theodore Dreiser. We get a whole high school curriculum of what was considered lit in around 1959, what would have been assigned in good high school classes, of what the American books were. And there they are, shrunk all and each to one page in an earlier issue of Zero Zero. My sense here is that there's an incredible fullness. There's much more material than there is space in the world available. In other words, so the strips become almost like an attic, because your father was a cartoonist and your brother...
Still is.
Yes. He's still in Czechoslovakia, yes?
Yep.
And your brother is a cartoonist, so we have a family system going, first of all. And family...
And I also have a younger brother who's really, really turning into a first-class short story writer.
Oh, that's great. What's his name?
Seth.
Seth Deitch?
Seth Deitch, yeah.
We'll look out for him.
Check out Chris Ware's Ragtime Ephemeralist, number 3. There's a really nice short story by him, illustrated by me.
Oh, that's great. And so... we've got the father, who is the connection, I guess, to a whole generation of old-time cartoonists. And these are people you know both privately and because of their work, and you know their characters, the characters that they've made who've inhabited different screens. And that sense, too, that you know a person and his creations enter your stories so that... for every cast of characters, say of animators, you've got a cast of caricatures, of cartoon characters that they've made, so that eventually these frames have to be dense because the people in what they make are climbing, playing leapfrog with one another, climbing on each other's shoulders, it seems. Now, also, there's that sense, when you look at it, that this world is so full to bursting that the only way to hold on to all of it is to risk insanity. And insanity seems to be a big thread and theme of the work, that these people here who really are doing their stuff end up paying repeated visits to sanitaria.
It's an occupational hazard of this, you know. It's not easy coming up with this stuff. I mean, look at all the alcoholism among writers of books. Let's face it. It takes its toll, you know. It almost seems sometimes like you have to make the choice: great material or mental health. I'm trying to. Do both, have mental health and do great stuff, but it's tricky, although I've come to love it over the years.
Uh-huh. You know, is there some amount of anguish? Because death, insanity, alcoholism, it seems as if the basic ground is finding ecstasy from out of misery.
Gosh, I don't know. What can I say? Basically, what I'm trying to do is entertain people. I mean, you know, and to do that, I'm trying to entertain myself. If there's any kind of anguish, it's when I can't come up with the stuff. And I've, you know, over the years, I've figured out enough ways, knocking on wood, to find a way to come up with it, and always, you know, more or less, always have something, some kind of an idea of what I'm supposed to be doing every day.
Now, you've been doing it for 35 years now, approximately.
Yeah.
What's changed?
Well, what's changed is it used to be a lot more anguish. It used to be like I'd go into incredible slumps. And it used to be that I didn't really like to draw. Over the years, what's changed is this. Little by little, I guess about 10 years in, I think I hit the point of, well, you know, I don't know exactly when it happened, but I like doing this now. What happened, to make it short, is I came to enjoy the process and, you know, actually love doing it now. And, you know, what I did overcome, which was the worst thing, was just, you know, bad spells where you couldn't come up with anything. I shouldn't be talking like this. I'll put the whammy on myself. But, you know, little by little, I figured out, you know, by staying ahead of myself, by learning a few things about the nature of ideas and how they can develop in your mind, and having enough things developing in your mind so that you're always going to have something ready to go, so that I got to the point where I could get more out of my bones, because I'll tell you, there's no more worthless feeling in the world, as far as I'm concerned, than sitting there and thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Which was, you know, often the case when I, you know, was back in the 60s working for the East Village Other. Come Monday morning, it'd be, well, time to do a strip. There's the paper. Here I am. What's going to be? You know, well, you know, the trick is you don't sit there and wait for Monday morning. You know, you'd be thinking about it. You'd be taking notes. You know, do a million things. You learn one thing, which is, every good idea starts out as a half-baked idea, mm-hmm. And you know, so just write it down, keep it handy, let the old subconscious mind be working on it while you're working on something else. So those are some of the things that have changed.
There's a mad world that the artist is struggling to get into shape all at once, and that it's not the single figure. Yes, Waldo might look something like Felix or Julius, the Disney version of that cat, but Waldo is just a transition figure. Half the time he's transparent and he has a soul. He's the figure who leads us between who we are and what we want. What we want when we're at our worst, when we just want more or want sex. Then there's the Sandman, who takes us to another world of creepy dreams. But when they all come together, when you have Waldo and Sandman and all these characters and all these creators, you have what's, you know, a plenitude cubed. And that is the sense, the imagination bursting, that I imagine people admire most in Kim Deitch, and the thing I think that makes it hard to be Kim Deitch. You have to let all of that stuff stay in you and never leave. In other words, this is endless memoriousness, yeah?
Yeah, hey, you know, it's really not that bad. Being...
It does have a kind of historical dimension. Like, it is somehow, among all those other things that you're talking about, it's also tracking a history of a medium from pretty early on, from the Winsor McCay moment to now, and also somewhere obliquely some kind of family history that parallels or echoes Kim's own, you know, background.
Yes, it's the beautiful thing of an artist, as always, being not the typical or the essential person, but the atypical. One senses about some artists that they remember everything they've ever seen. Others that they remember everything they've ever heard. Some cannot forget anything they've ever thought. And I guess that I'm interested in that artist who can express not the ability to unitize the mind, that is to make a schedule and get from Monday to Friday, but to get to Monday, from Monday to Friday, while thinking about everything at once, that the mind doesn't put anything to bed. And so, you know, when you look at the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, it's a picture of real life when you think about the fact that you dream. And you remember while you're talking to your boss about something your father said. It's an attempt to represent on a comic book page the mind expanding itself because of what it helplessly knows. I know that that sounds ridiculous, but that is genuinely why I find it so enjoyable.
Well, good. I'm glad you like it.
Does it make...
You know, part of my problem is, you know, I can't get into heavy self-analysis about all this when I'm doing it, or it would stop me dead in my tracks. I have to just, you know, like, do it.
Yeah, but that's because I think you're already in heavy self-analysis when you're doing it. I think you're doing it is your heavy self-analysis.
Yeah, well, maybe so. Maybe that's what it is. But, yeah, you know, I just have to be very careful about it, the way I think about it. Or I could put the whammy on it with too much soul-searching.
I've been speaking to Kim Deitch, who is... with Simon Deitch, the author, artist, creator of The Boulevard of Broken Dreams that was published recently by Pantheon, a beautiful graphic novel-related book. I say related because it's all sorts of things in addition to a novel. It's sketchbooks, it's songs, it's got all kinds of features in it. Introducing him.
Oh, I appreciate your precise definition, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You know, because it really isn't a graphic novel.
That's right.
You know,
it's a roundup. No, it's a pleasure to be interrupted.
Yeah.
Introducing him has been Art Spiegelman, who was introducing him, Kim Deitch, because he introduced Kim Deitch to me, Kim Deitch's work. Thank you both, Kim and Art, for joining us today on Bookworm.
Oh, hey, great to be with you, Michael.
Pleasure, Michael.
I've been talking with Kim Deitch and Art Spiegelman about The Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You can see an excerpt from The Boulevard of Broken Dreams on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical directors have been Ray Guarna at KCRW and Chip Christarella at the Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan. Special thanks to Ken Beck at the Museum and to Alan Howard and Mario Diaz at KCRW. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.